Chris is missing. Okay.
Welcome everyone to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is May 9th, 2017. We have an informational meeting today about foster care, big topic for this committee, and some of the things that have been coming up. This is not a particular bill or even budget item that we're considering right now, but some of the things that have come up in the course of hearings here, but also conversations we've had outside of this room, are some of the barriers for foster families or foster care organizations that want to take care of kids, and barriers of one kind or another have come up. So we're going to start first panel with Kayla Lynn, Rich Ransom, and Candace Williams. And these are at the invitation of Representative Andy Olson. Is that right?
That's right. Madam Chair, thank you.
Would you like to say a few words?
Yeah, I appreciate it, yeah. Madam Chair and committee members. So just, you know, really quick here, you see on your agenda there that Kayla and her husband, Corey, live in Albany. That, well, all three of these happen to be constituents, you know. So God bless them, first of all.
You got the littlest constituent, too.
Yeah. So this is working out really well. Candace and her husband, Craig, live in Albany as well. And Candace will share with you that her and Craig became foster parents July of last year. And then Rich Ransom and Julie, they also live in Albany, but they had been foster parents for about 16 years. All three of them were at our town hall that we had, that Representative Stark came down and attended about a week and a half ago down in Albany. Oh, close to 2 weeks ago now. And from that point on, I thought, you know, we have some issues. There's a lot of great things that Department of Human Services does. You know, and we know that. You know, I'm a major advocate for that agency. There are also some issues that just are tough too. And I've never really gotten so deep into the side of it for foster homes, foster parents, the foster kids, like I have probably this last few years. But having the town hall that actually was created on the idea and the concept of wanting to recruit foster parents turned out to be more of a session that people had to kind of just blow out. And it was a sense of healing needed to be, but it was a relationship type issue. Mm-hmm. That's why I asked you then, and my colleague, vice chair, that if we could do this and move forward with and kind of listen a little bit of the stories here. I know Don Darlin is going to come on a little later on today, and he's the president right now of the Oregon Foster Parents Association, too. So I'll just stop there and let Kayla start.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kayla Lynn. I live in Albany, Oregon. I work as a social worker behavior specialist with the Lebanon Community School District. I probably most recently had the intersectionality with foster care in our Lebanon Community School District as a dad shot a mom and killed her, and the children were needing to be placed. We currently in Linn County have 87 general foster care homes and another 59 that are specific, so that when they're specified, someone has a relative that they're looking to take the placement and they'll get signed up. Other than that, the 87 foster cares in Linn County wasn't enough to be able to continue to keep these children within our Lebanon Community School District area. Not that transportation under McKinney-Vento doesn't happen. It ended up that a principal within our district had just recently become foster care certified, had three of her own, two foster children, and took two more into her home just to keep those two from being separated. From not being separated from each other while they were dealing with and working through their own grief before a permanent placement happened. From that, a bit of a groundswell in my heart and within my power and ability within our community school district have asked foster care certifiers to come out in our community and start that conversation. And we're in the midst of that. We've done our first presentation and looking at who is building interest to be able to have a certification class in our area. I appreciated when I talked to Chris Sterling of DHS, who's one of the foster care certifiers, just about some of the details with which I could sell that opportunity, which looks a little bit like you could sign up for general foster care. You could also say is getting certified within the Lebanon Community School District, that if by chance a need arose and it was a child within the Lebanon Community School District, that you can specify the needs. That doesn't mean that you're not going to get a phone call and have a two-month-old wanting to be placed in your home and figure out if you could say no to that. With that said, I work in the school end of things, and we know if you look at research, the outcomes of unstable living, moving from foster care to foster care, that compared to other foster care students have a higher increase of school suspensions, lower state testing scores, higher high levels of grade retention, and high levels of dropout. And if we think about the many movements that I've heard, and you'll hear from the foster care stories of movements in and out of homes and what dysregulation that brings to children, and the trauma of the experience about being moved out of the home and whatever has come in the past, we're hoping that us adults get to wrap our arms around the most vulnerable of the children in our community, and that we have a higher level of support, not lower level of support, for those specific children. That's my calling within my work. Here's the calling that you're going to hear 360 days, 365 days, and 360 degrees of the two sitting beside me. With that said, certainly we are trying to percolate more foster care homes within our community. And I would reach out to think about what is the funding for that. I know that there is a stipend. I know it doesn't cover all needs. I know that if I looked at ongoing support and the training that's available, I think about the training that I'm putting in place of the staff that works within my community school district, and the ongoing training is necessary to work with children 8 hours a day who are from homes that may be unstable. I think about what that must look like and doesn't happen for foster care families on an ongoing basis, what that incentivized information looks like. You know that the buzzword is trauma-informed care. You know that that's not a conversation that they're learning a plethora of, that we're giving a lot of other agencies that expertise, but not someone who's got 24/7 accountability for children. So in thinking about that trauma-informed lens, thinking about child development, crisis intervention training, collaborative problem solving, it runs the gamut of which I'm willing to provide for a teaching staff who's working with children 190 days a year. Mm-hmm. So my push is for that conversation. I know in the town hall meeting we heard something about every child movement, something for you to look into. I've added it on my Facebook. I'm asking you to add it on yours, every child. That within our community, I know is beginning a conversation. It's planting a seed for me to think about maybe it's not becoming foster care certified within our home. I'm looking at doing it, and have had a conversation about being able then to be a respite for in somebody else's home, because I ran into someone at a town hall meeting and asked about how do you get respite, and if I get foster care certified, a little bit of the back door is that I could come in and be approved to be able to be a safe person. Yes. Who's got a lot of skills and training and background at least to give. But that doesn't happen without a groundswell and without information being able to be out there. So what would that look like? Also, what would it look like to honor the people who are doing foster care? I know that within, if you looked at the Every Child movement, they've got people bringing donuts and dropping off flowers and just saying thank you, because you know that being all about the children is having us be able to ask, how are the children? And our children in our foster care communities need and deserve, they are most vulnerable. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, my turn. I'm Candace Olean Williams. This is Presley. My husband and I got certified to do foster care in July. through the Tsleil-Waututh tribe. So we are tribal members. Our certification process was a little different than the typical process. It was actually a lot easier. Mm-hmm. I have friends that got licensed through DHS, and most of them are relative caregivers because people are scared. You know, they're a little nervous. I've had, since we've done it, she's baby number 6 to reach through our household. Our first two were 2 and 3 when we got them, a brother and sister. They turned 3 and 4. Here we go. By the time I got them, I was household number 4, unbeknownst to me, within 6 months. We had them for just over 7 months. They were hard kids. They had been through it every which way. While DHS was trying to do what they could, I was trying. There was communication errors. Sorry.
It's okay.
Lack of communication. It was a fight to get them what they needed when they needed. You know.
What are some of the things that you asked for that you thought they needed?
I lucked out a little bit more than some other foster families, but these kiddos needed counseling. It took me months to get them into counseling. They needed speech therapy, occupational therapy. They needed to get into early intervention in the school. All these things that a lot of them you need approval for, and by the time we got approval, it's like we're looking at months down the road. And that's typical, where instead of these kids coming and us as foster parents being able to have this stuff done, I mean, I found out I was getting these kiddos the next morning. I had multiple calls in because I'm lucky and I have connections in the special needs world because of my previous job. So I had phone calls. I told them, here, I'm waiting for approval, but these are the kiddos. This is what I know. And even with me having, you're going to tell your story. even with me having the connections, it still took months because we had to get DHS to say, yes, you can do this, or okay, you know. Mom had to approve a lot of things, which was difficult given the situation. These kids were violent towards themselves, towards others, and I mean severely. I have 3 biological children, 11, 8, and 6, that love these kids. Oh, they loved them. They were instantly brother and sister. And my kids were being physically abused by these kiddos, and we're doing everything we can to stop it. And I mean everything, you know. We got the kiddos into counseling. That was going well. And sorry, I'm going to say it, because of laws and rules and regulations, reunification is always top priority. So what happens is they were pushing visits, they were pushing phone calls, they were all these different things, and the kids weren't ready for it. And that is probably the biggest issue that I have encountered, is we're not communicating, we're not, you know. And it's not just one way, it's all the way around. We need to have better communication between foster parents and DHS, between birth families and families. We really need that communication, because it started getting so bad with the 2 that I had at that time. They ended up leaving to go to a therapeutic home with no other children. They went back to mom. They were given back to their mom within a couple weeks. Mind you, counselor was saying, not the best idea, okay? But counselor left, and things took roll, you know, and they went back to mom. That lasted a handful of days, literally. And they are now on their 4th foster care home since January. I have the luck of being able to do respite care for them, so I have seen them. They call me on a daily basis. I got a call this morning. They didn't want to get up and get ready and do what they needed to do, so they needed Aunt Candace. They needed stability. I couldn't get the help that I needed, you know, so I could give them that stability. It was a hard situation. We still struggle with it. But on the other hand of that, we have little Miss Presley. Like I said, baby number six in our household, or kiddo number six. She's amazing. We have had, DHS has worked really hard on letting us have a great relationship with her mom. So she is going home, well, supposedly any day now. And mom and I have a great relationship. We talk. Mom has asked me to be her mentor when she gets out of the rehab center, and without DHS involvement, you know, just mom and I as friends and mentors, and DHS actually fostered that. At the same time, we have had communication issues yet again. Example, she wasn't supposed to be with me today. She was supposed to go home yesterday. DHS forgot to have the conversations. I mean, counselor, mom's counselor, me, DHS, we're not doing it. So while I appreciate and understand DHS has a lot on their plate, my request as a foster parent and my hope, so we can have more people out there to help the kids. My request is, let's open the doors of communication better, whether it's something simple as an electronic calendar that DHS can look at, that foster parents can look at, so we know, hey, this is going on. So we're not getting a call at 9:30 in the morning saying, hey, you have to drive half an hour away and you have to be there in 35 minutes, which happened to me numerous times. You know, we need to find a way that with everything going on, the children are still our primary focus, and we have to find a way as adults, as providers, one way or the other, to communicate, to make things easier for them so they can get what they need. So us as foster parents aren't exhausted, stressed, and as she was saying, the respite, the respite care is a big one. The issue with the respite care that I have come across, even with people that I know and love, is, hey, we have to take this long class. We might as well just be a foster parent at this point, because we're doing all the same things as foster parent. I think that for respite providers, for daycare providers for foster kids, there needs to be kind of happy medium a little bit more, instead of, hey, basically become a foster parent, but say you don't want to take the kids, you just want to babysit. You know, there needs to be a little bit easier way to come about that. And I think more people would be open and willing to doing it. That's my experience.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
My name is Rich Ransom. My wife and I foster parent for about 16 years. And you can see my voice is breaking now, and it probably will as I go through this, because it's been extremely difficult, even though it's been a long time since we've been away from it. Over the course of those 16 years, we had a little over 100 children through the house. We did temporary, we did shelter care, we did long-term, we did short-term. We had kids come 3 in the morning, we had them come 3 in the afternoon. We had the police would bring them oftentimes. We had children that came that were beat with razor straps, old-fashioned straight razor straps. You know, the barbershop used to sharpen their razor with it was 4-inch wide, okay? We had children that were pulled out of garbage cans at 2 in the morning. We had children that were severely sexually abused. We had children that were severely physically abused. It was tough. But we had a good 16 years, basically. We had a good relationship with it was CSD back then, Children's Services Division. Then it went to SCF, Services for Children and Families. Now it's DHS. So if I say CSD or SCF, SCF, I'm aging myself. So anyway, well, I can say we had good relationships. We knew basically all the caseworkers. We knew the police. We knew the branch managers. We knew the supervisors. Well, we adopted one of the children that we had in foster care through the system, And we adopted another one through a private situation. It was a relative of my wife's. When we got her at 5, she crawled on 4 knees, on her hands and knees, and growled. Okay, fast forward a few years. After we adopted her, she had a reactive attachment disorder, if you're all probably familiar with that. Her parents stole some identification when she was born, and of course, she never had any involvement with her parents because they were gone, and their rap sheet was about this long. They couldn't come back into the state. So she was dealing with that. She was born with cocaine in her system, several other drugs in her system. She had a tendency to be very violent. She was extremely manipulative. Well, one day, she didn't want to do her homework, and she didn't like our rules of doing the dishes or whatever, and she said that I threw something at her and hit her in the head with it. Okay. SCF comes in, DHS comes in, takes her, took her down to the emergency room, no bruises, no marks, no scratches, no contusions, nothing. Couldn't find anything. Take me down to the police station, interview me. Police found nothing. I had no charges. She was removed from the home. I and my wife, who was not employed outside the home, was forced to pay child support for 5 years while she was in another home until she became 18. Our whole life went crashing down because of an accusation that it came up unable to determine. That was the final ruling. At that time, there was it was valid, invalid, or founded, not founded, and unable to determine. They were the three rulings that would determine whatever you accused were. However it was worded. But anyway, our final disposition, I guess, was unable to determine. This happened to also several other families that we knew. We had another family, Annette, who had over 20 years. She was accused of something, and she lost all her children. She was never recertified. Nothing was ever founded. She also was unable to determine. Another family that we knew, 15 years, same thing. It was extremely, extremely difficult. And one class that we took when we were first getting started, the class was called What to Do When You Are Accused. Okay, now wouldn't it be a good idea if DHS had I don't know if this class is still offered, but wouldn't it be a good idea that if indeed a class like that was offered, that the people that were in charge would think, wait a minute, if we're offering a class called What to Do When You Are Accused, maybe we should rethink how we're doing this system. What about a standardized system for accusations? At the time, and I'm not sure how it works now, but it was basically up to the caseworker to determine if indeed to investigate or determine an accusation. Well, there was no standardized situation. I knew lots of other parents, we knew foster parents, that their kids could fall out of a tree, they could fall off their bicycle, they get a bruise, bang, the child's gone. Okay, what about looking at this and saying, okay, did you fall off your bike? Yeah. Okay. Get back on your bike and have a nice day. There needs to be some type of standardized system to determine what is abuse and what isn't. Now, don't misunderstand me. There's legitimate abuse out there. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there needs to be something, again, a standardized type of situation. Also, with her, at the time when she said that I threw that item at her and hit her with it, when the DHS came, I said, would you folks please come, let me show you where she was. Oh, let me recant. She also changed her story about 3 different times during this process over the following several months. Now, granted, again, she has reactive attachment and all these other labels that she had. She had IEPs, but she didn't, and was having trouble in school because she didn't want to do what she was supposed to do. So as that progressed, I would call the caseworkers, I would call the branch manager, I would say, would you please come out to the house. Let me show you where she was, because she told them where she was, and she told them where I was. It was impossible for me to throw anything and hit her with it where I was sitting. Wouldn't come. Wouldn't return my calls. I even went down to the office and walked up, knocked on the window, and wouldn't even talk to me. We were just totally ostracized because of that. We were very active. My wife and I helped. We basically started the Linn County Foster Parent Association. We had, again, lots and lots of good things happen. A lot of the kids that we have, we still have relationships with. Some of them come back and visit us. We'll see them at the store or on the street. They tell us about what great times they had when they were with us. We had lots of accolades from the agency. We have even little certificates that print up say what great foster parents we were. But all because of one accusation that was not founded, everything came crashing down. And when you think about paying 5 years of child support for your own child that you adopted, and with all these accusations that can happen, because basically you're guilty until proven innocent, and then you're still guilty. Why would anybody want to be a foster parent? It's just so risky out there today, and there are no protections. And also at the time, I was even thinking about hiring an attorney to try to fight this, but of course, who's going to have to pay for the attorney? Me. And at the time, and again, I don't know if that's still the case, but the agency had the ultimate power, and it would not even open up the files to let the attorneys see it. They just had the ultimate power and said, no, we're not going to do it. So that's basically what my experience. And I thank you folks for your time. And
thank you.
Hopefully we've been a little informative for you.
Thank you for highlighting a lot of the challenges for foster parents. And DHS will have a chance at the end to respond. And, of course, they can't respond about any particular case, but they can tell us what they're doing. And there's substantiated, unsubstantiated, and inconclusive, I think, are the three categories
okay. Now.
And so we'll thank you for raising your concerns about it as it at least stood a few years ago, and we'll see where we are now. But we appreciate you putting it on the radar. And, Candace, I had a question for you. I know that Native children are disproportionately in foster care, and I wonder if there's any attempt to put Native kids who are seeking foster care with your family.
Every kiddo that we have had in our home has had some ties to the tribe. DHS has called a few times. Of course, they can't call me directly because I'm tribal. Mm-hmm. And so, but they've called the tribe and asked mm-hmm. for us to take kiddos through them before. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of a limbo family. I don't know. I sit there and I get phone calls. That's kind of how it works for us.
So it's at least happening informally. Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rich, in your process, did you feel like or what sort of support did you receive from anyone that you didn't hire as far as helping you navigate?
Zero.
Okay. And was any offered to you, or did you have an opportunity to ask for it or anything?
The agency wouldn't even talk to me. And I tried to get help, but I didn't know who else to ask. No, I had no support. And we were just, like I say, we were devastated. How could this happen? How could we go from here to there?
Like
that.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Nope. So Madam Chair, thanks. You can see all three of these folks here. There's been a calling in their life mm-hmm. to get to where they're at right now and how much they care about kids. They also understand the energy level that needs to be for the connection too with the agency. And there's a lot of good folks. Mm-hmm. There. What this was really designed for today, I think, more so now, is are there some things that we can identify? Are there some barriers that we can break down? Are there some things that maybe we could step forward with and help the agency, the department with tools? This is not a bashing session for me, mm-hmm. just flat mm-hmm. not. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're getting a chance to see just feet on the ground, what's going on. And, you know, I think, well, just about everybody here has, you know, seen this. So I just really appreciate all three of you showing up today.
Thank you. One more comment.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then to summarize, these, for those who are watching and sitting here, these three really have expressed an overall sentiment that throughout different foster parent or foster child halls or town halls that we've done, a few things that I think are consistently coming up as frustrations for foster parents. One is a timely response from DHS, mm-hmm. clear communication from DHS, having a voice in the process and the decisions, having an advocate when things aren't working or when things go wrong, mm-hmm. and then challenges that have been coming up as far as recruiting foster parents is really all about fear. Fear of false accusations, fear of harm to other children, and fear of the power that some feel like independently that DHS has. So those were ongoing themes at almost every single town hall that I've been to with foster care.
I would echo all that and say training and resources.
Resources.
I hear that over and over again, and I hear that from you, and respite, and, you know, opening up access to more respite through perhaps a shorter, more directed training. We do want trauma-informed care. I mean, there's certain things that we keep saying you need more of at the same time as we want it to be as efficient as possible. But a network, you know, I know we've talked about the Mockingbird model and the NAIA Generations and Bridge Meadows model where you've got other families. You're placed in settings where you have other families who can be supportive and respite. Really, like, right on the premises, even. Yeah. So right. There's a lot of models there that we're exploring, trying to be more supportive of. I know DHS has some networks, and I hope they talk about that when they come up here. What are the efforts that they're doing to try to really increase support in some of the ways that you've identified needing? So, did you want to say anything else?
I think he hit it right on. Yeah. I mean, I've talked to friends that would be willing to mm-hmm. do foster care or respite care, but they're scared. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's fear is the biggest one, and then mm-hmm. you see these things going on and the lack of support, and, you know, DHS has a rep, unfortunately, you know, mm-hmm. and so I think building community relations mm-hmm. and kind of letting the community see that DHS isn't mean, you know, that they're really helpful, because there are amazing people. Mm-hmm. I have a worker that she randomly called me when I didn't have kids, because she, or foster kiddos, because she knew it was my kid's birthday. You know, she called to say, hey, how'd the birthday go? Mm-hmm. I think we need more mm-hmm. of that. And for us to just praise each other, we're not getting that. Foster parents aren't getting praise unless you come to something like this. But, you know, we're not. I know DHS isn't, and that's hard to do a lot of work with no recognition.
Yeah, you know? And I will say also, I know that, you know, we are constantly on DHS to be more accountable, because every story that comes out there about a child that's been left in an unsafe situation, and so they're often between a rock and a hard place on that, and trying to find, you know, trying to find the sweet spot in the middle and grow that sweet spot.
Sure.
But I hope that you stick around, because there are a couple of people from Embrace Oregon and Every Child that are doing exactly what you're saying, trying to really support DHS and support foster families, and make the pie bigger, and do it by really adding a lot of support, substantive support, moral support. And I know we need to think about financial support as well to the system. Thank you very much for coming. Okay, so next we have Christine Camps, and I'm not sure of the other name. Sorry. Do you know the other name, Tana?
What's that?
Christine Camps, and
yes.
One more.
Kara.
Kara
Dodson.
Dodson. I can never remember her last name. I don't know why.
All right.
Thank you. Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, my name is Christine Camps. I'm an enrolled member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, and I'm also Indian Child Welfare Act consultant with the State of Oregon Department of Human Services.
Chair Kenny Geyer and
members of the committee. My name is Kara Dodson. I work for Department of Human Services. I'm a supervisor of an ICWA unit in Multnomah County.
Can you articulate that, ICWA?
ICWA, Indian Child Welfare Act unit.
Thank you.
If it pleases the committee, I'd like to give a quick summary of the Indian Child Welfare Act that we'll be referring to as ICWA throughout the presentation, if that's okay. The Indian Child Welfare Act is a federal law that maintains focus on its greatest resource, tribal children. The ICWA was established in 1978 because Congress found an alarmingly high amount of children were being broken up by the removal, often unwarranted, by courts and welfare departments and placed in non-Indian foster homes and institutions. Before 1978, 25 to 35% of the Indian children were removed from their homes and often placed in non-native homes. 85% to 90% were being placed in non-Indian homes. Shortly after the act was established, there were BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs guidelines that were established in 1979. We have not had any movement on ICWA since 1979. Recently in 2015, BIA guidelines were released. And then 2016, ICWA regulations were released, including a new BIA guidelines that were released. This is a very exciting time for the Indian Child Welfare Act, and we're excited for the movement now that we actually have some regulations with regard to the Indian Child Welfare Act to help us with maintaining compliance with regard to our Native children and our tribal families. Throughout the history of Oregon, we've held a long, important value for tribal relations and tribal sovereignty. We have established a number of programs throughout DHS to reflect this important value. One of that is that we've operated an ICWA program since 1978, and the Tribal Affairs Unit at a central office has been the primary focus of that since 1978. Nadja Jones is the Tribal Affairs Director currently, and we have two ICWA consultants, myself and Emily Hawkins. Emily Hawkins is actually in the back there. We are very excited to start this work. Emily and I are fairly new to this role, and our job is to help with ICWA compliance across the state and to help the branches with regard to ICWA and also provide technical support to our tribes across Oregon. The Tribal Affairs Director, Nadja Jones, co-chairs the ICWA Advisory, along with Clyde Seike, the Director of Child Welfare. The ICWA Advisory is an opportunity for us to come together with our 9 tribes and to be able to discuss any challenges or successes that we're having with regard to our tribal children. We do meet on a quarterly basis, and we do honor that and respect that relationship. It's a time for us to come together and honestly speak about challenges that we're having, and then also, again, success that we're also having with regard to our tribal children. The development of relationships between the state and the tribes is an ongoing process that we take very strongly. We have mutual values and respect for the government-to-government relationship and the concern for child welfare. Oftentimes we get questions of why the Indian Child Welfare Act is established and why other populations don't get the same federal mandate. And really what it comes down to is the sovereignty, the government-to-government relationship between the state and the tribal sovereign governments throughout the United States. Currently, we have 4 ICWA units throughout the state of Oregon. We have 2 in Multnomah County. Kara Dodson is one of the supervisors there. We also have 1 in Marion County, which is in Salem. And then we also have 1 in Lane County, which is fairly new establishment. We are hoping to see more of a wide variety of ICWA units across the state so we can have more of a specialized knowledge with regard to ICWA when it comes to working with our Native families. That has been one of our focuses, is to make sure that we're training and getting people that really know what the Act is about, people that actually respect the Act, and that know how to work with our tribal families. That's been a big focus of ours. One of the initiatives that ICWA units have in place is to have a 30-60-day staffing with the out-of-state tribes and in-state tribes to help keep them up to date on what's happening with regard to their children. This is something that ICWA units are currently doing, and it's been found to be pretty successful. What we found is that we often struggle with communication with some out-of-state tribes, not all, but some. So in order for them to stay up to date of what's happening, it's really important for that communication to be open and for us to be having ongoing dialogue with regard to case planning and what's happening with regard to their children here in Oregon. I'm not for sure if you guys heard, but we do have a 1-to-3 ratio with regard to out-of-state tribes versus in-state tribes. So a lot of the children that we are involved with, that are involved with DHS Child Welfare, are from out-of-state tribes. I'm from Muscogee Creek Nation, so I am from an out-of-state tribe. And for an example, my tribe will not get involved if we're not within the service area. So that's often a barrier that we often see with regard to ICWA, is tribals, the tribe's resources and ability to actually be able to step in and work on these cases. And then we go from a whole other side of the gamut where we have really active tribes that are able to step in and intervene in cases and be able to be at the table at every court hearing. If we could,
I just want to ask a question. When you say 1-to-3 ratio, do you mean for every one Oregonian tribal person, there are three out of state?
Yes.
Wow.
And metro area is one of the highest areas for the out-of-state tribes. I don't have the exact number with me right now, but that is a reason why we have two ICWA units there, is that we do have a high population of tribal children in the area. And my understanding is back in history, that was one of the relocation cities. So we had a lot of displaced families there, and we have a lot of now out-of-state tribal members within that area. We're currently exploring ways to engage our out-of-state tribes more effectively. One of the ways that we're trying to get a voice for our out-of-state children is the local Indian Child Welfare Advisory Committee. I don't know if you guys have heard of it, but they do have it in Washington. Mm-hmm. And we have been working with the state of Washington to try and partner with them to try and see if we can get that established here in Oregon. We have had two districts that have volunteered to participate in that pilot. One is District 2 in Multnomah County, and the other is in District 9, I believe. Yeah, District 9, which is out in Wasco area. The LICWAC serves an advisory capacity to DHS by recommending culturally appropriate case plans and services for Indian families. So when we have a tribe that's not available to be present, or they're unable, then we will have the local Indian Child Welfare Act committee that will be able to speak towards case planning, culturally relevant services, and just make sure that we have an eye on these children and making sure that we're doing what we need to do with regard to child welfare services. Cases can only be staffed with the local Indian Child Welfare Act committee when the child's tribe is unavailable or they've requested staffing. So we will not move forward with the local Indian Child Welfare Act committee without having the express approval of the tribe or for us to move forward. The reason behind that is that we want to have the child's tribe present. That's the most important thing. And if the child's tribe can't be present, we want them to be able to support us being able to have people in the community be able to speak for their children. All the notes and stuff that come from that committee will be filtered back up to the tribe so they can take a look and make sure that they're happy with the recommendations that are happening. Those are only a few examples that we're doing with regard to tribal engagement throughout the state, but it's an ongoing process, and we're really excited to continue the work. Now, Kara is going to talk a little bit more about some other things, initiatives that we've been focusing on.
Correct. I wanted to tell you about some successful strategies that we found in my district, District 2 in Multnomah County. And one of those is the use of ICWA units. It's a strong feature in DHS. It allows for topical experts to be available around key decision points and collaboration with case managers. In District 2, we are able to recruit caseworkers that have knowledge and experience and also a desire to work with our Native American families. We provide these workers additional training, and we also we're able to have a smaller supervisory to worker ratio. So we have 10 workers to 2 supervisors, so we have 2 units. It also has been wonderful to have 2 supervisors, because then we're able to coordinate schedules, provide maximum coverage for each other and for all of our caseworkers. We also are familiar with each other, all the cases in the unit, so we can be interchangeable. Workers in our units have reduced caseloads because that gives them the time that they need to ensure that active efforts on every single case are occurring. We also have been fortunate enough to have a very high retention of workers in our unit and a very low turnover of caseworkers. So when new caseworkers come in, which I will say we have about 1 new worker every year, which is great. And so that one worker that is coming in is able to take cases as they learn, as they progress, as they're ready for those cases. And so they're not a caseworker that's walking into a completely full caseload without really knowing the work itself. And so we're able to provide that support for our new workers in the unit. The supervisors and workers have close relationships with our Native American providers in Multnomah County. We work together really well. We talk and we problem solve when issues arise, and we provide cross training between our agencies so that we understand kind of where each other are coming from. And we also, there's a strong emphasis in our unit on the family decision making meetings, which is an evidence-based practice. And that brings all the parties together on a regular basis to help support the families and then also provide that level of transparency that's needed amongst all of those that are involved in the case. Additionally, I wanted to talk a little bit in our District 2 about our foster care recruitment efforts. So in May of 2015, so about 2 years ago, we identified a need in the metro area, and that's including Districts 2 and 15 and 16, which is Clackamas and Washington counties, in addition to Multnomah. And we formed an ICWA recruitment team to coordinate recruitment activities in the metro area. In February of 2017, the GRACE Project Director became a standing member of this committee. The team strategizes ways to be able to provide more Native homes and to support our Native children that are in DHS custody. In 2016, the team members participated in about 8 recruitment events tailored specifically towards the Native American community. And each of those events yielded between 4 to 14 names of potential foster parents. Areas that the Tri-County recruitment team has identified as more needing more efforts for 2017. So our goals are doing a more coordinated handoff. So having workers and certifiers with the potential foster parent, the name that they may be, the person that they talk to at the recruitment events. Actually having that same person make the initial call or outreach to invite the person to an orientation or maybe a meet and greet or maybe just for coffee. Also identifying potential Native foster parents early in the certification process. And when I say identify, it's like it's more around tracking so that we know exactly that this is a potential Native foster parent, so we know who that person is, and so we can provide support and, again, kind of hand-holding through the process and be available to answer questions. Identifying specific certifiers with skills that can engage and work specifically with Native American foster families, and also creating joint foster parent and ICWA caseworker trainings. So I think when we're sitting, again, that cross-training, when we're sitting together in trainings and we're learning about best practice, that makes for better work and collaboration between caseworkers and foster parents.
Thank you. I'm going to discuss a little bit about active efforts, if that's okay with everybody.
Yeah.
Active efforts is a key tenet with the Indian Child Welfare Act. Active efforts is required for Indian Child Welfare Act cases, and it's a higher standard of effort. So I like to give a simple example of oftentimes the agency will be put referrals out for clients, so they'll call or send an email out and get a referral out for a client. With regard to active efforts, we would actually go out and take the client to the appointment. We would address any barriers the client might be having with the treatment provider, sit down for initial meetings, sit down for ongoing meetings to make sure that the client is successful and remove any barriers that we can to help the client throughout the process.
Is your client the foster parent or
the client of the child welfare? The parent.
The parent, the bio parent.
The parent.
The
bio parent.
Okay.
So that's just one example with regard to active efforts and how we try and reunify the family as quickly and safely as possible with regard to our Indian Child Welfare Act cases. Active efforts, the ICWA requires efforts to prevent removal of children from the home and efforts to reunify post-removal. We have information systems in place to track past post-removal. But we are struggling a bit with trying to track active efforts prior to removal. So we are working with ORCIDS, our business process with regard to our data system with DHS. We're working with them to try and figure out different ways of tracking active efforts prior to removal, which is a very big area of ICWA compliance and making sure that we're doing what we need to do with our families before children come into care. In 2013, the legislator approved 9 positions for active efforts. They are across the state. They're in districts 2, Multnomah County, 3, Marion, 4, Lane. I don't have these all memorized, so I'm not going to try. So 4, 5, 7, 6, 8, 10, 11, 15, and 16. So they are widely across the state of Oregon. We do have more information on those positions if you'd like to gather more about the people that are in the positions and really what their focus is. So we're happy to send that at a later date if you guys would like to take a look at that. Excuse me. We are very excited about these positions. They really are. They're non-case caring positions, and they're able to help the caseworkers with extra efforts with regard to families, family needs, children's needs. They're really being able to be plugged in anywhere and everywhere that we need some additional assistance with regard to our families. Kara Dawson actually supervises one of our active efforts specialists. I'm not for sure if you had anything you wanted to add with regard to that position.
Well, you did a nice job at that.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So now I'm going to ask you the tough questions now. So you talked about the foster family recruitment. How many did we actually get certified through all those efforts? And if not, tell me some of the barriers to getting those folks certified.
Well, I think, first of all, the first barrier that I identified is we don't even know who is sitting in those trainings that is kind of coming down the pike to become a foster parent, because there was absolutely no tracking through the training process of race or ethnicity or even what type of child that you might be interested in. There might be a family that would be interested in taking a Native American child. So there was no tracking of that.
And that's just standard?
Well, we've improved that process since then. But yes, now when we at least at the very initial, we are actually tracking that. And also, when I mentioned that the person that actually talked to that potential foster parent at that first event is going to be the person that then makes the outreach to them to bring them in, that there's so that was another barrier. And that was another way we were losing exactly who it was that was this potential foster parent.
Okay.
So those are two efforts that we're trying to do to resolve that issue.
How many do you have? Sorry, Madam Chair. How many Native foster homes are there? How many ICWA-compliant Native foster homes are there?
I can't tell you exactly how many, but it's not a large number.
We're happy to provide that.
We can provide that at a later date.
10.
Any guess? Any range?
You would know better than I would.
I don't know across the district,
okay.
But at my branch, my educated guess would be between 10 and 20.
Okay.
We also partner quite a bit with our 9 tribes as well. So if there are availability in their homes, so we will partner with them to help place our children in their homes as well. So that is something that we've
like
been working
Candace.
On.
Like mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Situation.
Right. Mm-hmm. But also, like you heard from her, we also have a challenge with regard to recruitment and getting families that actually want to foster. I don't think it's because they don't want to foster. I think it's just the system itself can be very intimidating. And you also heard a lot from her, just some challenges that we have with regard to communication and some other just barriers of getting people engaged in the process to come on over to us.
Lots of questions, sorry. So can you tell me kind of maybe what the ratio is in terms of caseload for ICWA caseworkers versus not ICWA caseworkers, because you mentioned a lot about kind of how that's smaller, so you can actually do more active efforts, understanding that need and wanting to make sure that people understand also the caseloads that non-ICWA workers have to deal and, you know, maybe don't have time for anything that looks like active efforts.
Right. So at my East Branch office in a permanency unit, the average children on a caseload are between 18 and 24 on a regular permanency caseload. On our ICWA caseloads, our average is 9. Yeah. However, many of our workers carry more than that because if we always have one new person, that means we have a new person in core, mm-hmm. or we have a person that's in their first year who may only be carrying half of a caseload. So they might only be carrying 4 to 5 kids their first year of work with DHS. And so that means the rest of the unit usually carries between like 10 to 14 children on their caseload in order to kind of subsidize your one newbie.
Lots of questions. So
let's do it until 9, and then we'll turn it over to the
sure, absolutely.
Minutes.
So tell me a little bit more. I'm looking at your list here. Tell me a little bit more about those some of the other barriers that we have towards just in particular recruiting for Native foster homes, and then relative placements. Because I'm always been concerned about relative placements and trying to be able to get kiddos with relatives if they can possibly do that, given that that's the first tenet of the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Right. Do we want to talk about
this? Right. So we did put together a little handout for you, a one-pager. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
do you see the back of this, guys?
This is about challenges and barriers to providing child welfare services to Native American families. And there is a section here around relative foster homes and then also Native foster homes, where we kind of discuss some of the issues and barriers. Would you like me to go into
that? I would like you to elaborate on that just a little bit, if you would, please.
With our relative foster homes, there's times when a relative might have an inability to provide as a foster parent due to maybe historical issues. And these can be, things that occurred 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. We, at times, will have barriers around it could be that the relative has substandard housing due to poverty issues that might prevent placement of children with relatives. So if they would need to be, they would most often need to be certified as a foster parent. And there are really strict guidelines around sleeping space. So certain age children need a certain amount of space. And if you have two children of a different gender and they're of a certain age, they may not be able to be in the same bedroom. And so there could just be clearly some space issues. There also might be structural repairs or different kinds of things in the home itself that need to be resolved before they could become foster parents. So those are some of the common barriers that we will see.
And do you have any resources to try to address any of those barriers?
Well, I think Embrace is here. And they, we have reached out to them at times to help us with some of those issues that have come up for our specific clients.
Okay. But there's no pot of money at DHS that you can use?
At times, if it's a more simple fix, we can use system of care monies. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then I believe that NAIA at times has had grants and some flexible funding that we could utilize for foster providers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any last questions?
Yes, please. Can you, overall, one of the struggles that I know occurs with families in general, either families who've, been involved with the child welfare system, families who maybe think about doing foster parenting but don't for whatever reason, I know that a lot of it stems from historical trauma. And I know that, the ICWA units do their best to work on those issues and deal with some of those struggles. I guess I'm concerned what happens when y'all are at capacity and you have a Native family coming in, because I know it happens a lot, and there's no Native foster home available, which, again, happens a lot. And how is how are we assuring active efforts? Are we able to assure active efforts throughout the system if those children are not in a native foster home and they're not in an ICWA unit?
It's a really good question. And I do think that there is a barrier to foster families coming to us, to potential foster parents coming to us because of historical trauma, or they have seen family members or friends be involved with our agency with really negative, you know, outcomes. When we are looking at placing children, we try to make sure that we've really tried everything possible to prevent that placement, and any plan that is a potential or possible plan to keep children safe, but to keep them within with their parents or within their family. When children do have to be removed, we are networking like crazy. And I know at times my workers have even contacted, my workers that are Native American have contacted friends and family and recruited. Mm-hmm. They've recruited from your former agency, NAIA, for people to become
agency.
Foster parents.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of a situation where we try to get as creative as possible. We don't just look at family, but we try to also look at kin and kith. So are there other people within this child's life that this child has been attached to that might be able to be foster parents? And then there are times when, well, and we're also talking with the tribe. Are there tribal members? Do they have any potential foster parents? Do they know more information about this family's lineage? Because mm-hmm. maybe there's other people in the community that are related to this child, or even do they have any tribal members that are living in the community or in the outreaching communities that might be willing to be resources? When children have to be placed in non-Native homes, we do our best to provide, you know, training around culture, and we also, our workers, because they have, you know, additional time and they spend a lot of time with their kids, we try to still provide cultural activities. And when we're looking at doing things like visits, we try to do those around cultural events and at different cultural programs around town. And so we try to incorporate those as much as possible. So
not optimal.
Yeah. We
do our very best.
I know you do.
Well, thank you. I had actually written down historical trauma when you said, I think you said before 1978, one-third of kids were removed from Native families, and only 90% of those kids ended up in, and 90% of those ended up in non-Native homes. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's just shocking. And then you think about those children who were removed from their family and then their non-Native homes, how they're really separated from their culture, and so many of those are the parents of children we have out there today. So trying to do very specific targeted programs that really address that historic trauma is mm-hmm. really needed. So thank you for your efforts, and we will I know we have a lot of passion on this committee for this, and we'll want to be tracking that and seeing the results of your active participation, whatever it's called, kind of a
active efforts
to keep kids in their homes to begin with, and getting parents the kind of, whether it's either parenting skills because they may have grown up as foster kids, addictions, which we know is a big issue in that community, and all the supports they can to be great parents, and then when they are in foster families, to the extent they can be put in families that are connected to their heritage, and to the extent they're not, cultural training and other. So it takes a lot of efforts on All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We do have a video that's probably 2 minutes long that does a nice little clip of the history. If you guys are interested, I can have it sent to you for
that would
review.
Be great. And we can put it on all us so that it's there for everyone, the public to see as well. That'd be fantastic. Thank you so much. Okay, next we have Shelley Winterberg and Brooke Cray.
While they're coming up, Madam Chair, can I point out, if you guys have not seen the
Brooke Ray's Oregonian article.
Yes, fantastic.
It was perfect timing.
The Army Behind Every Foster Child. Guest opinion.
Perfect
if you haven't read it, Oregonian 2 days ago, look it up.
Well we should done. Actually put
we
that on
We have to start
Olus.
Out by embarrassing
Let's make
her.
Sure. Can you send that link to Ashley so we can put it on Olus?
Sure. Look at that.
I was wondering if that, Brooke, if you timed that to coincide.
I did not.
No.
Yeah, you need to identify
quite
yourself.
Amazing.
I mean, it worked out
Even
really
though you
well,
are a star.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Good morning. Thank you to Chair Kenny Geyer for the invitation to share with you today. I'm Brooke Ray, the Executive Director of Government Partnerships for Portland Leadership Foundation, which is the organization that sponsors both Embrace Oregon in the Tri-County area and then Every Child, our statewide effort.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us. My name is Shelley Winterberg, and I'm the Director of Every Child that's overseeing the work as we expand across the state of Oregon.
It's an honor to sit here together as we consider and explore how we can improve outcomes for our state's children. Nearly 18 months ago, we were invited to share in this committee about a new posture that Portland Leadership Foundation's Embrace Oregon initiative had developed in the Portland metro area between DHS and the community. In the 4 years since its inception, Embrace Oregon has mobilized more than $2 million worth of non-governmental investments, thousands of volunteers, more than 700 foster family inquiries to demonstrate what we call the third way, where the community's role in partnering with DHS increases in order to better serve children and families. But it began with a mustard seed. An individual stepping forward one by one. For my husband and I, it was our very first call that dove us into this world headfirst. At 4:30 a.m. on a cold, dark December Monday morning, I answered my cell phone. Hi, this is Sherry from the Child Welfare Hotline. I have a 3-year-old and 5-year-old who've been found wandering the streets of downtown Portland alone. Could you just take them until DHS opens? We don't know anything about them. Of course, we leapt out of bed to prepare for our first arrivals. The toys came out of hiding. We got the sippy cups down, set out pancake mix, turned the heat on because we're those people in winter, plugged the Christmas tree lights in and to prepare for these little arrivals. With no kids of our own, and despite months of training and planning, we really had no idea what to anticipate in that actual moment. When the doorbell rang, a police officer stood there with 3-year-old Max in his arms. And Sophie, who was 5, boldly walked into the house and declared, "Hi, I'm Sophie," with a huge smile across her face. The officer placed Max on our couch, and he quickly fell asleep. And it took us just a few minutes to learn that Sophie's 5th birthday had been the day before. During the course of our 4 hours together, we held Sophie while she cried, "I miss my mommy and daddy." We comforted Max when he woke up and couldn't see his sister in immediate eyesight. We vowed as a couple that we would never be a home devoid of birthday candles again when we learned that she hadn't yet gotten to eat her cake. And we played house, and we watched TV, and we hugged, and we laughed. And we'd made a quick run to Target when they opened for new shoes and socks. And at 9 a.m., a caseworker showed up to transport them to a child welfare office where they would wait an average of 5 to 7 hours for a long-term foster home to come forward. Sophie and Max personalized the crisis for us. They gave us names and faces connected to the statistics, and they strengthened our conviction that this isn't just a DHS problem, that this is a community problem and one that we can't ignore. So We have been working overtime with the goal of changing the paradigm in the community from do nothing to become a foster parent, whoops, to one that invites people to partner with us in any capacity, from meeting tangible needs to volunteering to foster parenting. Today in Portland, we've seen hundreds of faith communities, community groups, and businesses that are working in partnership with DHS. From Casualty Underwriters Insurance Associations to Salt and Straw Ice Cream to Wells Fargo, Embrace Oregon is a citywide effort. We provide almost monthly hospitality events at each of the 8 DHS child welfare offices, and community members are stepping forward with more and more creative ideas about how to engage the foster care system. Altogether, over 3,800 volunteers have stepped forward. We've seen 800 tangible needs met when DHS requests help from the community, from bunk beds to a prom dress to airline miles. There have been over 15,000 welcome boxes made, which are like memory boxes full of items for a child when they first enter foster care, and record numbers of families who are stepping forward. We believe that DHS is only as strong as the community that engages with it. And so we took the dare that our community was strong, that it just didn't know how to help, and that given the chance, the community would step up and link arms with DHS. And now we are expanding statewide.
In 2015, after the proven success of Embrace Oregon, we began another big experiment at the invitation of DHS called Every Child. You see, the momentum was beginning to grow, and the number of inquiries that we were receiving on our website from foster parents and volunteers was climbing drastically. Inquiries were beginning to pour in from every corner of the state. And beginning in Lane, Jackson, and Josephine counties, we set out to prove that what we had learned in Portland could be replicated across the state. We boldly believe that the Every Child initiative could change the way Oregonians think about foster care by committing to our four core values, the first of which is hospitality. Relationship is the currency for everything we do, and we develop initiatives for community members to regularly serve children in foster care and those who care for them. Whether Dutch Brothers Coffee, who donated gift cards for every DHS staff working in Linn County, or a gourmet s'more company who set up their food cart for all the families who were shopping Toys for Tots during the holiday. Every child celebrates hospitality, and we facilitate it in the community. Another core value is our counter-narrative. We share stories, like Brooke's article, that offer a counter-narrative to the stereotypes of foster care, foster children, and foster families. Stories like Sophie and Max. We have over 12,000 followers on our Facebook pages. And this is a place that allows us to reflect the complexity as well as the beauty of the foster care journey. Social media has become a powerful tool in our community mobilization efforts and foster family recruitment. Our third core value is creating accessible on-ramps for involvement. We ask community members, what can you bring to the table? And we're committed to offering practical ways for individuals and families to engage, whether by meeting tangible needs, volunteering, or becoming a foster parent. And lastly, we are relentless about foster parent recruitment and support for foster families. We are continuously sharing the need for more foster parents and have developed special events to allow individuals and families to learn about what it actually is to become a foster parent from foster parents themselves and provide wraparound support to support foster families. When we began work in Lane, Jackson, Josephine counties, we estimated that it would take 2 years of grassroots community mobilization work to actually see a collective and collaborative initiative develop. Instead of just expanding Embrace Oregon, we wanted to develop a new model that honored the nuances, strengths, and cultures of each distinct community in Oregon. The expansion to Lane, Jackson, and Josephine counties was an experiment. Could the model of Embrace Oregon be translated statewide? Could the initiatives developed in Portland, from welcome boxes to office parents, be scaled to other counties in Oregon? would the federation model work? And after just 1 year in these pilot counties, the answer was a resounding yes.
So in June 2016, we boldly proposed the expansion of Every Child to two more counties over the next 2 years to DHS's central office. Although they were gracious about our proposal, they believed that community engagement in the third space that we occupied was a new literacy that we needed to develop together. In August of last year, they countered our proposal and asked us to expand to all 36 counties in the next 5 years. DHS provided a matching grant, and Every Child is fundraising independently to make this a reality and to ensure sustainability long term. From Portland, we're leading the rally cry through marketing, social media, through consulting and technical assistance by creating an Every Child Service Center. And in addition to transcribing all of the initiatives that Embrace Oregon develops, the Service Center creates video content, shares stories on social media, and provides this assistance to local nonprofit organizations who are accredited as Every Child organizations across the state. In each county, the local leaders of Every Child will lead their local recruitment efforts for both volunteers and foster families, will coordinate volunteer efforts, will lead the relationship with their local DHS office, and support foster families that emerge. In essence, it's a federation model that respects the nuances and differences of each community in Oregon. For the 9-year-old child who stayed in a hospital in Medford for 4 extra days, not because he needed medical attention, but because there were no homes. For the 14 kids in Lane County who bounced between foster homes and caseworker care because no long-term foster families stepped forward. And for the thousands of others, from Bend to Burns, from Coos Bay to St. Helens. This is a problem that needs to be tackled by the community, both at the local level and statewide.
So this year, 2017, we're beginning work in Columbia, Coos, Marion, Polk, and Yamhill. And as a bonus, Lynn and Benton counties are bursting at the seams and will likely unroll a formal Every Child initiative in the next 3 to 6 months. Totally unplanned. We've launched a brand new website, everychildoregon.org, and a very sleek data management system that we're super proud of. And on April 10th, in partnership with DHS, we launched a public service announcement campaign that was being televised currently on 43 television stations and over 200 radio stations. These powerful stories are calling on more Oregonians to say yes to caring for vulnerable kids in our state. And perhaps most impressive is we are seeing inquiries of people interested in foster parenting beginning to climb. We're averaging 49 inquiries a month, which is a record high, and warmly handing off these folks to their local DHS offices. In fact, at the end of 2016, we fielded 495 foster parent inquiries, and 21% of those came from other parts of the state outside the Portland metro area. Momentum is continuing to build, and folks from across the state want to get involved, to partner with their local child welfare office, and to respond to the crisis in foster care in our state.
Foster parenting isn't for everyone, although we believe it's for more people. And from national studies, we know that it takes potential foster parents an average of 3 years to go from educated about the need to diving in, so to speak, and opening their home to a child. By challenging the previous paradigm of do nothing or become a foster parent, a community is rising up where everyone can bring what they can to the table. Because they're learning about the foster care system, they're meeting children in foster care, and they're discovering how they can help. More and more people are stepping into foster care that would not have otherwise taken the plunge. It's happening one person, one community, one county at a time, and the local organizations and leaders that are carrying the Every Child Initiative in their community are contributing to the counter narrative by sharing stories of foster families and highlighting community members who are sacrificially giving to improve DHS offices. All three of the child welfare offices in Lane County were beautified, every visitation room made over in the last 6 months. These local organizations are providing hospitality by delivering soup lunches to a DHS office on a dreary Friday, creating welcome boxes for Spanish-speaking children that are entering foster care. They're offering on-ramps through volunteer initiatives, adopt a foster family, support teams, and respite care. And they're recruiting foster families through community-based orientations, trainings, and events. We know Oregon's facing incredible challenges, and these are our collective challenges, not just DHS's. The good news is that Oregonians are rediscovering the principles of effective compassion. People have begun to count compassion the only way that transforms. One person, one relationship, one child, one family at a time. And so we ask this body to keep dreaming with us about the Every Child Initiative, where one day we will have a safe, loving, and strategic foster home for every child in Oregon. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And of course, I have to comment. May 18th is the Every Child launch in Josephine County, and I love it. There, as far as changing the dialogue, you know, it's an invitation throughout the community for people to come and enjoy and get to know the office, get to know the workers, and at the same time host a lunch for the workers. And so it, to really, they're doing a great job of just bringing the community together. And I love that, you know, as in my pastoral role, when you talk about going out and doing events, everything tends to cost money. It seems like every fundraiser, every event, every awareness thing, there's some sort of give us money. Mm-hmm. Every child doesn't do that. They go in and they say, give us your time. Mm-hmm. Get involved. And if you care about children, we have a place for you. Mm-hmm. And we'll figure that out. And they're doing a fantastic job of that. I'm so proud of the work they're doing, and I'm excited to see it launch. I'm emailing right now, actually, in the last couple of minutes, trying to figure out whether or not I can get excused up here for the day to go down for our launch. But I don't know if that'll happen.
If it's a Tuesday or Thursday, yes.
Well, there's one.
From this. You're doing your committee
work. In fact,
work
it is. Is it? But it's during, I mean,
give
that's
us a report.
Along
maybe a few other things.
So you guys are doing great.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Fuso.
More a comment. I just really appreciate hearing positive things that are happening. Yeah. We sometimes go way too far on the other side, and you're doing tremendous things. I have to say I'm not familiar with your organizations, but I will be after we walk out this door, so thanks. It's great stuff.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Appreciate the work. Mm-hmm. Fantastic, really needed. Mm-hmm. I guess my concern then is DHS ready? For all the folks that you're recruiting. Mm-hmm. And I'll ask them that too. Are they ready, and have we, you know, worked on the training process and that engagement process with workers and all of those different things? And I don't know, that may be a question for you. Are you all prepared to assist with some of that?
Mm-hmm. We are. So actually how some of the model has worked with Embrace Oregon is DHS has been really gracious to allocate a certifier for every family that's coming forward through the Embrace Oregon work at each of the 8 child welfare offices. So we get to then meet with those certifiers every quarter and talk. They've become a bit of a learning lab where we're talking about customer service. We're looking at issues and challenges and how things are interpreted across different county lines. We have just been allocated now 3 new certifiers for every child in the Tri-County area. And so we're able to provide some of our tone and messaging and advice, if you will, on customer service to those folks, which is great. Yeah.
May I comment?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had the pleasure to actually go and sit in for a while on one of those trainings. And again, it's fantastic. And I loved that the energy and the optimism in that room was different than most groups that I've sat down with caseworkers and certifiers. Mm-hmm. You know, they were enjoying themselves and encouraged and excited about what they were going to do, even though we know that day to day they are overworked. It was just, it was different than any of the other meetings I've been to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'll just ditto to everything that's been said. I first met you, I think, 3 or 4 years ago before you came to this committee, and I was so excited about the idea of recognizing what the problems were, reading what's happening in the newspapers, recognizing it, and then being really problem-solving oriented and positive and saying, rather than beat up on the DHS caseworkers who are scrambling, and there's something like 40% turnover every year because their jobs are so hard, and everything we talked about earlier about how parents are scared when Rich was talking about, you know, how parents are worried about getting into this line of work because they might be accused of something. DHS workers certainly feel the same thing. And so to provide moral support, substantive support, both for the workers as well as for families is really critical. In addition to supporting, and I think you said 3,800 volunteers so far, 800 tangible needs, 15,000 welcome boxes. Do you have numbers yet? You know, I know there's a average of 3 years time before people first hear about it and think about it. Do you have any numbers on actual direct care with kids? So of those volunteer, of those 3,800 volunteers, how many actually became respite volunteers for families, or how many actually, how many people have actually become foster families so far?
The Portland Metro, the number is 250. For
250 become foster
parents, yep. As of a year ago, 27% of the general applicant foster families in the Tri-County area had come forward to the agency through Embrace Oregon, which is remarkable. For the statewide work, those numbers were in the midst of a data sharing agreement with the agency, and or developing a data sharing agreement, rather. We know that we've passed off already at least 60 inquiries just since this began in the last few months. So that's really exciting. But we know that our matriculation rate, if you will, is about 30% for families that go from interested to foster parenting to becoming a foster parent. That's about 20% higher than the national average.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're anticipating a big wave of new foster families here in the next year.
And then do you, it's still very early on, but have you had any foster families who you've attracted and who have started and then who have dropped out because of frustrations or anything like that?
Sure. I think what has happened actually more frequently with our foster families is that they drop out because it's an adoptive case. So, you know, they have kids in their home and they're finished. But yeah, we've certainly had a few that have started and realized that it's not for them. We started creating these events called Explore Fostering Coffee Houses. We host them in coffee shops in the community and have a panel of experienced foster parents. And it is just a no-pressure environment for anyone who's in the information gathering phase around foster parenting to come and hear the real nitty-gritty details of foster parenting. We have a certifier who comes from DHS as well. And those have actually been remarkable in helping us even to weed people out who aren't ready. We really are intentional about having a positive, hopeful tone. But as foster parents ourselves as well, we don't have rose-colored glasses on when it comes to this work. We think it's important that people really know what they're going to be stepping into. So we consider it a win when somebody comes to that coffee house and says, actually, I'm not quite ready. Saves the agency a lot of time and heartache, too.
Do you have an email list that that people could join if they want? And then if they hear about any of these coffees, maybe members here could, you know, just listen in.
We do,
or maybe become a foster family or a respite family.
Yeah. If you're on Facebook, like our Facebook page, because that's where all of the events are, Every Child Oregon. You have a little brochure with the website, which you can sign up for newsletters there, but I'll leave a stack of my business cards, and you're welcome to reach out directly. I'd love to connect with you. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, really fantastic. Thank you. So we have a call at 9:30 with
Don Darlin.
Don Darlin, who is the head of the...
He's the president of the Oregon Parents, Foster Parent Association.
Perfect timing.
Good morning, Don Darlin here.
Don, hi, this is Representative Alyssa Kinney-Geyer, and I've got Vice Chair Andy Olson next to me, who invited you to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.
And invited you to
Oh.
It's an echo.
Yeah.
Can you hear us? Uh-oh. Don, can you hear us? Maybe we should just try again.
Yeah, no.
Don Darling here. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me? It's Chair Kenny Geyer from the Human Services and Housing Committee.
Try that. I've asked Representative.
Okay, we're going to try you on a different number.
Yes.
Okay, bye.
Feedback is bad.
So you're going to have Kevin come up there for a little bit.
Yep.
Because he's worked so hard on this whole stuff.
Yep.
Oh my gosh, I did not realize.
That's the so much.
Good morning, Chair Geyer.
Hi, good morning. Good, we're not getting the echo anymore, and I've got Vice Chair Olson by my side here, and I appreciate his inviting you to this committee, and we were hoping to hear from you for 5 or 10 minutes about your role as the chair of the Oregon Foster...
President.
President, the Oregon Foster Parents Association, I believe. So please introduce yourself and tell us what you'd like us to hear.
Okay, well, thank you, Chair Geyer and Vice Chair Olson. To clarify, I'm actually the treasurer of the association. I started the association in 96, so I have served as president. I'm not currently president. That position's a little vacant right now. But my name is Don Darland. I've been my wife and I have been a foster parents for 26 years out of Linn County. And we have taken in 70 plus children. And my largest role over the years has been to advocate for foster parents when they're going through allegations or anything kind of negative with the system. I've also been very involved with the Child Welfare Advisory Committee, the Child Justice Act Task Force. At one point, I was on the Linn County Commission on Children and Families. So, being a disabled veteran, and it seemed like everybody thought that I had all this time on my hands, and I've been trying to retire for 9 years, and it just hasn't seemed to work. But I just kind of wanted to speak just real quickly, and for some of you, it's pretty basic. So I've been around quite a while, and we've been involved in some town halls, we being Oregon Foster Parent Association, and some other surveys, and I know the Grace Grant has done some surveys, and you know, I just kind of wanted to say that over the years, the last probably 10 years, maybe less, foster parents have felt a disconnect between the field and them personally. And I don't blame the caseworkers, and because they are overworked. They've got high caseloads. It's not operating at 100%. And I feel sorry for these young kids coming in. And I've also advocated for them. And so, but this disconnect is kind of caused this separation of just relationships. And some of you in the room may remember or have heard me say so many times, rules without relationships lead to rebellion. And we can legislate things, we can make all these rules. Everybody can have a Bill of Rights. But if we don't have a relationship to build on, then we don't build that trust. And I so am excited about what Embrace Oregon and what they're doing to build those relationships and trust factor. Again, it takes time. And that's one thing sometimes DHS just doesn't have. And we try to train foster parents to build that relationship, force that relationship, give them a break, give them the benefit of the doubt, and because they are busy. And the other thing is, I wrote a piece a bit in 2009, a couple pieces for our newsletter called Leadership Versus Management. And it's so important that we have leaders, not just managers. Because leaders really look at their people, you know, people first. Do no harm. When you're looking at children and workers and foster parents, I think the first thing we need to do is ask ourselves, what can we do that will reduce the risk of harm? And I know that's difficult now in this certain culture because of the news media, the things that have happened. It's easier to just go, well, let's move the child and then figure this out later. And every move for a child is very, very traumatic. And very traumatic for everybody. So when I talk about leadership versus management, it just seems like we have managers and we need to really become leaders in this system that says, I'm going to hold everybody accountable. I'm going to hold myself accountable to good practice, to the best interest of the child, and that's tough to do in this climate. And there's a couple quotes that I've learned over the years, one from Vera Fallberg, she's famous, and she said that every foster child deserves an irrational advocate. And she said that at a foster parent conference one time because foster parents were concerned. She goes, they go, you know, if I become irrational and advocating in court and I raise my voice or disagree with something, then I'm labeled kind of as the negative person. And, I mean, this lady is a psychologist. She, you know, every child deserves an irrational advocate. Mm. And it's okay for us to disagree. It's okay for us to not agree on certain things. And maybe even become a bit irrational. You think of a mama bear with cubs. Mm. Most foster moms, their hearts are twice as big as their bodies. And they're trying to protect their little cubs. And they might say things. They might have an attitude that, you know, you're hurting my child. And sometimes they can feel like they're just getting labeled as that's the negative person. And I'm not going to deal with that person, so I'll move the child. And I think that's why we've lost a lot of people. We've had some results in, like I said, town halls and surveys. And one of the biggest things that have come forward is, and this is nothing new, DHS knows, is that they just, foster parents don't feel part of the team. They don't feel like their voice is being heard. And they're not necessarily told every little thing that's critical in this child's life. And even to the point of why were they removed from the last child or home? Is there something that I need to do? Is there special supervision I need to provide? Mm-hmm. And we've had cases where it's not ended up well.
So, Don? And,
yes.
We, DHS has sat very patiently through this, and we do want to have a chance to hear them before the end. But I'm hoping that you can put whatever most recent survey that you've had from foster families onto OLIS with your email address if you're willing to do that, because I think there's a lot of interest on this committee and people may want to see and get invited to, you know, I go to the foster youth conference every other year, and if there was a foster parent conference, if you're open to having in anyone else from the Human Services Committee sit in, people may want to do that. So I'm hoping you can put that on OLIS.
Yeah, I've actually already got that.
Great.
And I've got several copies of things that I can send.
So we need to wrap up. We allocated 10 minutes for each speaker, but really appreciate all the foster parenting you've done and your role as treasurer for the organization, your past role as president, and all you're doing for to be a voice for foster parents on behalf of foster youth.
Well, Chair Geyer and committee members, I just thank you for the honor to even just speak. And, you know, I just thank you for taking this time to get the information. And hopefully we can go forward and get something positive done.
Yep. Okay, thank you so much, Don. Bye.
Thank you.
Okay. So, Kevin George, are you on your own or you got, okay, Cynthia?
I'm cooking.
We've got a fan club here.
Cooking.
Excuse me. Good morning, Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I manage the Foster Care and Youth Transitions Program at Department of Human Services. I understand we're short on time.
We're done at 10. At least, 10 minutes.
Yeah. So what I present, or what I prepared, is actually a PowerPoint that I won't go through in detail because you already have it and information for you. Some of the things I think there were questions about, just highlights of some of the certification we heard from. Certainly the foster parent with Siletz Tribe and talking about the DHS certification may be too laborious or on, you know, down that route. A couple things I would say is, you know, we're governed by statute, which is listed as far as, you know, that we're going to create rules around this kind of stuff. And what I would say is that when I have conversations or I go to national meetings with my colleagues, meaning the foster care managers in other states, oftentimes the conversations get to be around rules. What rules do you have? How do you recruit foster homes? And what I would say is we're a little bit out there, which Oregon used to take great pride in being a little bit out there with other states. Because a number of years ago, probably 10 to 12 years ago, I really pulled a group together and said, let's take our safety standards for foster homes to certify, and what do we need? Historically, the practice is you take the existing rules and say, what else do we need to add? Instead, I started with a blank piece of paper and said, we need to talk about safety. Where do we start? And then we started adding. So it changed and it flipped it upside down. So one of the things that people frequently talk about is around space. And many states will have, you need to have so many square feet in every bedroom for a child. I grew up at home where I didn't have my own square feet. You know, I didn't have my fair share, but that's the kind of stuff we took out. We said, look, that is not a safety issue. You know, is 60 square feet safer than 61? So we got rid of that. And so we've really taken ours into a whole different approach about how do you assess a family, more on who they are and what they have to bring to the table rather than a number of things that really don't impact safety or care for kids in some ways. And what I would say about that is that we then allow things such as we look for, as Representative Sanchez talked about earlier, we look for relatives. We look for relatives quickly and want to get children with their relatives if at all possible. Sometimes it means that, you know, 14-year-old Johnny is going to go with grandma, but grandma may not have a bedroom for him. But you know, when Johnny goes to grandma's house now, he sleeps on the couch. Is sleeping on the couch okay for a few days? And I say, yes, it is. If it's going to be a long term, then yes, we need to figure out a longer term solution. But there are ways we can do that. So we have rules such as an adequate place to sleep. That allows us some of that flexibility. So our rules, I think, are fairly flexible. And what I would really say is that anytime folks say that there's the barriers in the rules, I really support people to come forward and say, here's the rule and here's the why it's a barrier. The one issue that we have is certainly around criminal records checks and backgrounds. That's really legislated at the federal level. So we have some real limitations on that. But anything other than that, it's really the state who's making those decisions. So we have the ability to make some changes if we so desire. So basically, we have situations and some of the handouts you have. You know, you need to be 21 years old or older to apply to be a foster parent. We do allow exceptions. We have had, and again, I put in management exceptions from time to time for those unique situations. You've got a 20-year-old who wants to foster their sibling who is 15. they've got it all, their act together, they've got everything going on, they have the support, they can do this work, let's consider doing that. So we allow some of those things to do, to occur, but it's not on an ongoing basis for everybody. You know, we ask for things of an application. We get into your life when we're going to certify you. We actually get into your business. We get to know who you are and what you are about. And at the end of the day, if we say no, or you have a certificate currently and we decide we're going to revoke you, not let you be a foster parent any longer, there is a contested case process through the Oregon administrative law judge who actually will review these cases and determine, you know, did DHS do this correctly within rules or not. So there is a venue for folks to really take that. Another area that we changed here about 6 years ago, and we've been continuing to move in this direction, is home studies. And people talk about home studies, and that is the time we get up in your business, absolutely. And what we took on was a new model called the SAFE, and it's a structured analysis and family evaluation. And this is an evidence-informed model where it comes out of a consortium for children in California. And we looked at a number of other states and a number of other models that that people use. And this is one that really allows us to really ask those really great, hard questions that none of us really want to answer. But it's a way to bring it forward. And it's a way for families then to really evaluate, as Brooke talked about, sometimes families step in and then they're going to step out because they realize this isn't for us. So it's things like questionnaires that one parent and the other parent will both fill out the questionnaires. And it may be at times in separate rooms. And then you interview people separately and then you bring them back together. Okay, let's talk about drinking. Dad, you say you drink 6 beers a week. Mom, you're saying he's drinking 14 beers a week. Mm-hmm. You know, let's talk this through a little bit. And those are not automatic exclusions in this. But what it means is that we as then a certifier, the foster home certifiers, need to go in and mitigate that issue. What is going on here? Do we have some false reporting, some fact around communication between the parents? What's happening in that family? But we're really asking a lot of really hard questions as we go on. It's also a situation where this approach with SAFE allows us to mitigate issues of family's history. We all have stuff in our history. And for some families, it may be, while we're talking about drinking, it may be an issue where there was an alcoholism in the family. Maybe they grew up in a alcoholic family. That doesn't mean they're going to be excluded from being foster parents. It may mean that what I'm going to explore as a social worker for that family is, talk to me about how that impacted you growing up. Talk to me how that has impacted you with your relationship with your kids. Talk to me about stress. What happens when you're under stress, and how do you handle that? So it's those kind of things as a social worker. You need to be able to explore all kinds of arenas around them and really look at what might trigger you. You know, are you, if you lose your job, is that going to be a trigger? Or we need to be thinking about other kinds of things. And it really is, what is the impact of children in your family as far as the stress? Because as many of us know, you know, children coming into home can be really stressful. No matter how they come into your home, just being in the home. You know, every time my wife and kids would have extra kids in the house when I'd come home and there were 6 kids instead of 3. You know, that impacts everybody. So how do you deal with that stress in your family? Child abuse history, we do complete child abuse histories on families that are applying. We are looking at, do we know this family? Has this family told us things that we need to know about? And we're checking our system. We're also checking out of state. So if they've lived in Idaho in the last 5 years, we're going to call Idaho and say, can you please do a background check on this family for us? Again, any of those issues that are coming forward, we're going to discuss and potentially mitigate, meaning we've made a plan for that and we're done with that. Now let's move on. There are some times where it's going to be one of those that we can't get past what has happened, and then we're going to deny somebody their opportunity to be a foster parent in this state. I'm going to keep going fairly quick, and I know I'm talking fast, so please put up the timeout sign or something if I speak over somebody. Criminal history check is another one. So we're doing background checks on folks. And this is both through the Oregon LEDS process, and we're doing federal or FBI checks on fingerprint-based checks as well on folks. And we're looking for multi-state offenders. We're looking for a variety of things there. So two things we're really looking for. One is, did the applicant honestly report their history? Mm-hmm. Second of all, do they have a history? Mm-hmm. And what are we going to do about that? So folks that are coming forward and saying, I have no history, and then we pull up a LEDS report, and all of a sudden there's 15 different episodes there. It's like, okay, well, now we have a new conversation to talk about. Or it may be that somebody doesn't necessarily have a list of convictions, but they have a history of arrests. let's talk about what these arrests are about and what's kind of impacting that. But there are some of these that are automatically disqualifiers at the federal level, and so we have to honor that. And it's things such as felony conviction of homicide, felony conviction of abuse of a child, felony of kidnapping involving violence. I didn't bring them because it's 22 pages of rules that actually we worked with the Attorney General's office on, saying the federal government says these are the, they refer to as never, never crimes. You can never be a foster parent or adoptive parent. And then we've actually applied those to all the Oregon criminal code as far as what are those same crimes here in the state. So that's a challenge for some families, absolutely, because families have history. And it is an issue we've got to be able to deal with. But what I like about the way we've taken in Oregon is we've taken what's the mandate from the federal government and honor that, but the rest of the information is our discretion. We can make those decisions. So history is arrest. That's something we put in, and we can have that conversation then about what's going on. And it really is mostly focused around, you know, the behavior of that history, whatnot. And we do a fitness determination. And so we're taking all that information, and we're going down a litany of things. Talk to me about the details of the incident. When did this happen? Passage of time. Is this something that happened when you were 19 and now you're 45? Let's talk about that. What's gone on? What happened at that point in time that has changed you? Is that the issue here? You know, there's some crazy stuff that happens at times with folks. And here we are 20 years later, and folks are like, that's not me any longer. And as a social worker, we have to believe in rehabilitation. We have to believe in people change. We have to believe in we're all humans, and sometimes we just make stupid mistakes. And that's okay. We've got to be able to move forward on some of this stuff. I had a foster parent years ago when I used to be a certifier, and his history came up, and he said he didn't have any history. Lo and behold, something shows up. Showed up from the 60s. And he couldn't remember what that was because this was in the 90s. And he's like, talk to me. And so I'm sharing with, you know, it was robbery. And we got into talking about that. Lo and behold, oh, yes, I remember one time in college we went out and we stole a lawnmower from the neighbor. But he got convicted of robbery at the time. Said, you actually got convicted? Well, it was just easier just to admit to it and move on than it was to fight it. And so those kind of things happen. Length of time of certification. We have basically people get certified for 2 years, but there's a process that we have in place around an expedited process. So we can actually move rather quickly, meaning we can move towards certifying somebody temporarily today for their grandchild. We have provisions in place where somebody can actually get a temporary certificate really fast. The rest of the family, or the rest of the families, are being certified within really those first 180 days, and that's by rule at this point in time. But there are a number of things in there. Foster home certifier, these are the questions that people don't really know about. Your groups oftentimes talk about caseworkers. This is a similar group, but it's a certifiers, and so these are the basic six tenets that they are responsible to deal with. And I would say that the best certifiers out there are good, solid social workers. They're not policy, or they're not compliance officers. They're not going out there just counting how many, you know, steps you have in the house and a banister, or make sure the smoke detector's working, but a social worker that is engaging with that family and providing that real relationship as we develop things. I would say the other pieces that we have to really make sure we're doing is hiring the right people so they have the knowledge, skills and ability to actually do this work. That's the challenge. It really is. It's a hard piece of work to do. The number of certification staff we currently have is always another question. Again, as I said, they're classified as social service specialists, just like a caseworker. So I could be a CPS worker today and a certifier tomorrow. Some of us have that history. We basically have the certification group makes up 11% of the overall casework staff in the department. And that really equates to about 27 families each of them have. That's on an average. But you start getting out into like Baker City, where they have 35 families. Well, they only have one worker, and she's got to do all the work, all those six domains for everything out there. So you start understanding the capacity when folks were talking about what I really need is somebody to call me and check up how the birthday party went or stop in for a cup of coffee once in a while. That's the kind of work I need to get our certifiers doing is really that relationship building and the time to do that work. One is if the department currently were funded at 100%, we'd have a 35 additional certifiers on the streets doing this work that Brooke and Shelley are recruiting families for. So when the question is, are you ready? Yep. We are in the approach I've taken in this stuff. We are in such a need and such a crisis that we cannot be ready. We've got to be ready. So let's go recruit and let's get moving on this because we've got to do something for our kids. the challenges that I would say that we have faced here, a little bit different slant than when folks keep talking about we need more recruitment, we need more recruitment, we need more recruitment. What you heard today was retention. How do we take care of the people we currently have? And how do we actually then make sure that it's not just DHS, but it's the larger system, it's the media? So they put good stories in there. The Oregonian had 3 pages of terrible stuff the other day and a nice opinion by Brooke, limited to 500 words, where theirs wasn't limited to 500 words. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about that kind of stuff. What are we really trying to promote here? But making sure that everybody is a part of this the solution. The foster parents must be critical elements of the child's team. They've got to be having their voice heard. They're with the child 24/7. And resources and supports. And what we're really talking about there is foster parents over and over, we need respite care. We need child care. We don't pay for child care for working foster parents. Anybody wants to be a foster parent, I can't give them child care at this point in time.
You do put them at the front of the line for ERDC, right?
They are prioritized for ERDC, correct.
Now.
And then, lastly, as I lose my voice,
I'll get you some water.
I would move into the opportunities. And the opportunities that are there right now in front of us is every child is absolutely one of them.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. It is
full service over here.
She's faster.
I'll take yours, too.
I'll take it.
It looks like he's taking yours.
That's good. I'm just talking too fast, talking out of my voice. Every child is absolutely that opportunity. And when I love the way that Brooke and Ben and Shelley really phrased the part that we went to DHS with a proposal and they turned us down. First time I heard that, I thought, we didn't turn you down. And then they turned around and said, not only did they come back with this proposal, but now they asked us to explode this thing from 2 counties now into the 36 and how we're going to go across the state. So it really is that partnership and how do they come to the table, how do we come to the table. And quite frankly, I see my job is to connecting those dots and staying out of their way because I think they're doing incredible work and I love the concept of on-ramps, being able to step in a little bit, help out, whether I'm going to come and help paint a visitation room or I'm going to come help in another project. There's ways to do that and it provides people many opportunities to learn a little bit. GRACE is a federal grant we have right now that runs out in the fall of 2018, and it's very similar, which is, so we tied these two together. So I've had the GRACE grant working in our Southern Oregon area, and it really is about customer service. How do you take care of people? Mm-hmm. How do you change your office so that everybody from the receptionist to the branch manager, mm-hmm. all are respecting people? And answering that question, and when somebody is knocking on your window wanting to talk to you, you open the door mm-hmm. and let them in. So we have that piece moving forward. Foster Parent Night Out is another incredible project that's out there. We're not running it. The community is. Mm-hmm. This is a project where there's a number of churches who have come forward together to say, you know, we can host a foster parent night out. You bring your foster children down to our church. We'll let them run around. We'll let them watch a movie. We'll make popcorn and we'll play. You go out for a date night. You go out for 2 hours or you just go sit in the park and take a breath, whatever you need to do, foster parent. And so there's opportunities for that, and that's just churches coming forward. We're not paying any money for it. They're not asking for any money. It really is just something they're coming forward to do, and an incredible way to resource people is coming forward in that. Some of the innovative projects and evidence-based is that thank you to the legislature last year gave us money for 2 pilot projects, and then we've got those underway. They just launched this spring, one that's in the Washington County and Multnomah County area called KEEP. And it's from the Oregon Social Learning Center out of Eugene. And it really is a model where they're going in and in many ways coaching and mentoring foster parents. So you're doing your training, and then you've got somebody who's calling you every week. Again, customer service. How are things going? How's Johnny doing? How was that rough visit he had the other day? You've got somebody who can listen to you on a regular basis. So we're exploring that one right now. And then the other we're exploring is through Maple Star, Oregon. And it really is about reinventing foster care training. And support, similar concepts of coaching and mentoring people, but really having some core things around collaborative problem solving is a core structured training that they're teaching foster parents, trauma-informed care, and really, again, the critical piece for them is respite care. How do you give people a break? So those are some of the things that are happening. It was mentioned earlier, Bridge Meadows, a great program in the Portland area where they've got foster parents and with kids and an elderly. So it's a multi-generational housing project. The elderly, then, as far as their part of their commitment there is they have to volunteer so many hours. And they far exceed the amount of hours that they're required to volunteer. They do after-school tutoring, help somebody with their math. watch kids, that kind of stuff. It's a great little environment. They're taking the next step now and saying, this has worked so well here. Let's go to the other side. So they're developing New Meadows right now, which will be the similar concept of the elderly actually being able to support and mentor teenagers, those that are going out to their first apartment, first independent living situation, and yet they still then have somebody to check in with. Can you look over my resume? I'm applying for a job. How do you fill out taxes? Those kind of things that young people need. So this is just getting ready to launch in the Portland area. Mockingbird, somebody mentioned earlier, is a model that's in Washington. We've actually explored a little bit of that. What I'm trying to grapple with right now is how to expand the capacity of doing a Mockingbird in Oregon. They've got it in pretty small little areas in the Portland area, or in Washington right now. They are looking to expand it in the King County, their Seattle area, so that's informing me a lot of what we're going to do. I know Catholic Community Services here in Marion County has been looking at that model, and I understand that they're getting ready to do some launch of a model similar to Mockingbird here locally. So there's great stuff. I think the best thing that DHS can do right now is to continue to allow ideas to come forward, even old ideas that were once shot down, bring them back again. Let's take a new look at that, because maybe the timing is right now. I think we've got some great leadership, some great energy around this work, and together it really is about a community development. I took the opportunity then to make sure the very last page was something that I absolutely just fell in love with on Sunday in the newspaper when I got up, and this was really a quote from Brooke there.
Yeah.
I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
So I think we've run out. We've got to go, but that was fantastic, and I know that we're going to have more opportunities to engage with you. You're not far away, and questions about some of the things Rich brought up in terms of what do you do with inconclusive. I know that's been, we've been struggling with that in terms of legislation, so we'd love to continue the dialogue on that. But thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for staying over. Really valuable information, and we are adjourned.